Sports FM, not the fan. This is a weird thing to use for this guest, but sure. This insider is brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. It's the host of Fan Drive Time, Ben Ennis, taking a huge inhale to let his presence be known. Very alpha move of you. What's going on,
bro? I'm here.
Well, I'm the insider, so I don't know. I'm breathing in.
Not a big deal.
I don't know, all the information. I'm an incredible, knowledgeable insider. That's me. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, buddy. So that was one hell of a weekend. And this is where I'm going to start with you. Am I crazy? But that felt very playoffish. And I'm trying to attribute what exactly the feeling of it was, where I'm not sure whether it was because those guys wanted to step up for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., whether some of this is just natural regression, whether this is just the nature of being in some close ball games or the team actually won. But am I nuts? Those games felt really big, and they were unbelievably entertaining, but like it seemed as though there was like a different care factor from everybody involved.
Oh, there was a different, so I follow your logic when you compare it to playoff games when it comes to some of the managerial decisions. I mean, Jordan Romano did not get to finish that game on Saturday, despite the fact that he could have. He was only one out away. Yeah, he looked horrible. He looked incapable of finishing that game. So Ross Stripling came in, and a decision that was made that is not normally made throughout the course of a regular season. But as far as these actual games, like that game yesterday was hilarious and awesome, and it took forever, and it was back and forth, and it was super fun.
No, that was not fun yesterday, I got to tell you. Yesterday was actually not fun. You can't play baseball for 5 hours in a regular season game and expect me to be like, that was fun. It was great that they won. Thank God they won. But watching Jose Barrios get shelled and then watching like that cavalcade of pitchers and just the back and forth, no, that one was not fun. But the rest of the series felt playoffy to me. I'm sorry, it did. And if I was going to say so, that did feel playoffy too, going 5 hours to watch a baseball game, going, no, this is totally normal and fine.
Yeah, no, yesterday didn't look at all playoffy. It looked like, again, the end result and the final couple innings, exhilarating, but not, that's not the VHS tape we're going to send to the aliens and say, like, hey, this is the sport, it's called baseball, and it looks like this. There's a million guys committing errors all over the place, our starting pitchers
go, there's only
stink.
Five of these games a season, right? You go, no, we dedicate 160 nights to this.
Raimel Tapia and Bradley Zimmer in the lineup, and Kevin Biggio. No, yesterday was not exactly a playoff game.
No. Okay, maybe I'm just remembering more Friday night and Saturday granted, I came back Saturday night, watched the game. I was a little tipsy, but
it felt big. A couple sangrias.
I had a few sangrias. But it was a really fun game. Friday night, I was blown away by how entertaining the game was and how intense it felt at times. And I just thought, like, this is kind of the moment where you felt like this is more of a baseball team. And I heard them celebrate after the game. Like, you can hear them through the walls chanting. And part of that is just, like, it seems like they're a fun group who gets along very well. But point I made earlier in the show is that all of a sudden the depth guys are contributing. All of a sudden you've got, like, Gurriel having his regression moment happen where he gets 6 RBI in a weekend, and he's starting to look dangerous at the plate again, where it's just, oh, this guy's, he's going to hit doubles. Like, this guy's scary for hitting doubles now. He'll square one up, and when he does, it looks pretty. Matt Chapman had 4 hits that series, and he's been hitting the baseball hard for a little while now, and it feels like, okay, some of them aren't dropping into the right spots, but Chapman looks good. And Tapia has been a little bit better. And it just, to me, like, obviously the catchers have been, like, unbelievable, but right now Kirk looks like the toughest out on the team, where, like, every time he comes out, it's going to be a battle. It just, I love when depth starts to show up. And then you remember that some of these guys aren't just supposed to be, you know, 200 hitters. They're actually supposed to be fairly good. And this was the first feeling of, oh, right, this is what the picture of the Toronto Blue Jays was supposed to be this season. And we just didn't get it until May, late May.
Well, is that this has been the offense all season long. They didn't lose a series in April. Like, they won every single one-run game throughout the month of April with basically the offense that existed before this Angels series, right? Like, a team that didn't hit with runners in scoring position, kind of mediocre Vlad, a non-existent Teo and Lourdes. George Springer was basically the only guy that was going for the first month. It didn't seem to matter, though, because they came up with the hit when it mattered, and the bullpen was unreal, and the starting pitching basically has been as good as it's been from the start of the season. Yeah, it's this was the biggest reason to believe in the offense. Not that, you know, they're going to do something they're incapable of doing, but just doing things that they've always done. And especially the runners in scoring position thing. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. was the biggest offender when it came to hitting with runners in scoring position. So it's fitting that on a weekend where the Blue Jays go nuts with runners in scoring position, they're back. They're ahead of the Pirates again, by the way, in the leaderboard when it comes to batting average in Major League Baseball with runners in scoring position. They're creeping
That's
up to the
sick.
Mendoza
That's
line.
Sick.
Yeah, hitting Pirates. Like 198.
No, anytime you're ahead of the Pirates, you feel good. You know, you feel good as a barometer of success. Like the team that every year you go, what's even the plan here? You know, like what's the plan?
Correct.
You just hope you kind of fall into one year. Yeah,
yeah. The thing about Major League is there was an end game, right? They were going to sell the team. The Pirates, okay, step one, lose a bunch of games. Step two, they're like, continue losing a bunch of games. No. Yeah. Yeah,
They remind me of the soccer team that only exists to like build up players so they can sell them to more expensive clubs. You know, like that's their entire existence.
They're like the tomato can, right? Like they're whatever Boxcar Willie that Homer had to fight on the way to fighting Dredrick Tatum. Anyways, so they're above them. They're not quite at 200 with runners in scoring position. But, yeah, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., it's fitting that he's the guy that gets all the hits with runners in scoring position because that's what makes sense mathematically. Sorry, the math suggested that this was going to happen, and it was going to happen to one man in particular, and it finally did.
So then what's your biggest take from the series then? Because to me it was that the depth contributed and the team felt like the team for the first time.
Yeah, that the offense looks sort of normal and that if the starting pitching can continue to do what it's doing. And now, Barrios is another kettle of fish altogether because I don't know, he's had some good starts recently, but yeah, he really seems boom or bust. And I mean, the Statcast numbers for him are pretty horrific, so I don't know what's going on there. The other two guys, at least maybe three, certainly not four, I don't know if we can throw Ryu in there as well, but as long as the starting pitching can continue to do what it's done all season long, you could be on the verge of a real run. I mean, they've won five in a row. It feels like it's this team reaching its capabilities. I mean, this is a team that many people were picking to win the World Series at the beginning of the year. It's supposed to look like this.
So Barrios was kind of one of the major takeaways for me as well. And I don't know, it's just like, I had this weird thought and maybe I'm alone on this, but beginning of the season, Ryu was having like similar string of bad starts. Everyone was fired up about it. Kind of similar to Barrios right now. They put him on IL, maybe for an injury, maybe for like a mental reset. I don't know. Is it too early to think that's something to do with Barrios?
I don't know what the option would be. And the thing is, he was horrible in that start. I mean, just go back a start before that. In the Cardinals series, he went 6 1/3 and he actually struck out 7, right? Like he hasn't been, it hasn't been an awful start. Yeah, it hasn't been awful start after awful start. There's a lot of awful starts thrown in there. I mean, that, by my count, is 4 of the, whatever, 10 starts that he's had this season that haven't just been bad. They've been awful, which is not great for a guy that you just handed a 7-year extension to, and was your opening day starter. But that being said, I mean, if we're talking about regression with the runners in scoring position and people doing what they've always done, I guess you do have to kind of lean on history with Barrios here. And you're not asking him to be your ace, right? At best, you're asking him to be your third best pitcher. And boy, on Kikuchi's best day, is he your fourth? I'm not sure. But the Statcast stuff is a little concerning, like just across the board in the lowest percentile of like swing and miss, expected batting average against, like it's not been good. And I guess a couple of horrible starts will skew that a little bit because the Statcast numbers were pretty bad on Alejandro Kirk when he was going through it because he was hitting nothing but infield singles. And then guess what? You reverse that because you start playing better. So maybe that'll happen for Barrios, but he hasn't at all looked like the guy I thought we would see this year.
So what's most concerning for you? Is it his breaking ball not being sharp, his velocity being down, not getting swings and misses. Like, what is the major thing that he needs to solidify for you to feel more confident about him?
Oh, baseball is it's one thing. It's strikeouts, and if you're a batter, do you strike out or do you not? And if you're a pitcher, do you create strikeouts or do you not? I mean, that's the one thing that you can control. You can control once the ball goes off the bat into the field of play. Yes, you can have an impact on velocity or launch angle, but what you can control is striking somebody out, and they have no chance of reaching base. That's the best thing you can do, and that you could, you know, he has a career low in strikeout percentage is the most concerning thing by far. Now he complained about the baseballs a little bit. He also had some weird starts where, you know, he pitched in the rain in Cleveland. So, yeah, listen, I'm not going to get into the minutiae of what is happening with his mechanics because I couldn't tell you. But, yeah, it's just if I was going to put my finger on one thing that's the most concerning, it's not striking enough people out.
Well, I got to tell you that it's we do the whole, well, Pete Walker fixed the bad guy thing. You better get this guy going right, because this one would be bad. If this continues to this degree, he's not their third best guy. He's their number four. And you don't want to feel like someone is unreliable. So you're right. And this kind of just happens with the bats too, is you have a take and guess what? It ends up regressing. So on balance, what's more likely, that Berríos goes out there in the next start and has another meltdown, or he has a good start? No, it's probably these guys are going to have a good start. He's probably going to go out there and pitch well the next time that he has an outing. And so it seems like an overreaction right now. But no, that's the month of May where his ERA is 7. And you mentioned it. It's like people are hitting him harder, and he's not missing as many bats. And he's missing, those numbers are significantly worse right now. So you go, okay, maybe this is a blip. Maybe this is a blip. But here's one thing I hate about the guy, and I hated it last year too. I feel like when trouble starts to really happen to him, he loses his composure. And that's what's happened so far this year, is like once he looks, when you know he doesn't have it, he's never able to get it back. And you watch Manoah pitch, and it's like, oh, he didn't have that, or he got babbipped, or whatever the hell you want to put it as, hard luck, whatever. He finds ways to continue to battle and get himself back into ball games. And I keep bringing this up with some people, and some people go like, I'm nuts, and talk to me like I have two heads. And then other people go, you know what, I kind of see what you see. And that's what scares me about Berríos right now, is that over a large sample, this guy will prove to be a quality pitcher. You're right. He'll probably slot into being their number three with all of his numbers. His entire career has told us that, like, remember he was the face of non-SpiderTac stuff, where they went, everybody's using SpiderTac. Here's the guy that's definitely not, because all of his numbers are the same over his entire career. I'm just a little worried about, he's never had to be a big game pitcher before. He played for the Twins, for God's sakes, in the middle of nowhere doing Nothingsville. Now he actually is in a division on a team that has expectations and a bunch of stars around him and a bunch of other really good pitchers. And sometimes he just like really wears it poorly. And that spooks me a little bit. That's like, you and I talk about what clutch is, and I genuinely wonder whether that guy's clutch.
Yeah, I know. We had this conversation, you and I don't know if it was on air at some point last year, but we had this conversation last year, and, you know, he went into, well, fittingly, it was against the Angels.
Angels game against Shohei, and he got smoked.
And then you, at that point, declared him very unclutch. And then what happened at the end of the season? Okay. He had like multiple great starts against the Yankees and Red Sox. Well, the Blue Jays made that incredible run. Like, he was a huge, huge part of that run in September. He went seven innings, giving up one run against the Rays. Like, was that was huge. Coming off a 6 2/3 against the Yankees. Like, he was good down the stretch. So I don't know.
Again, when he's pitching well, he's got it and he's going well. It's when he starts to have those little blips, can he work himself out of them in big spots against good teams? I don't really see that consistently. I see a guy that starts to look like he's wearing it more and more and more. And I never like an athlete where I can kind of tell what's going on with them from looking at their face. And that guy just wears it on his face, man. Like, again, some people disagree. I feel like I see him very, very clearly.
Maybe it's his face. But maybe it's that his stuff is not quite to the level of a Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah. And when those guys don't have one of the pitches, they're able to rely on something else. And maybe those guys are just better than Jose Berríos, and when they don't have their best stuff,
100% better than
well, yeah. When they're coming out of the bullpen and they don't have their best stuff, they're able to gut through a start a little easier than Jose Berríos, who nobody's going to accuse of being like the best starter in baseball. His biggest selling feature was his consistency, mm-hmm. right? This is not an ace type pitcher that's going to blow you away once every 5 days, but he's a guy that will take the ball for you every 5 days, which is a huge, huge part of his appeal and his value. And two, not
no,
generally
Ben, don't do that.
You.
Don't Ben, don't you dare do that. Like, don't you R.A. Dickey, like Jose Dickey, Berríos yeah. in year one of his $160 million deal. Don't you, like, he gives you innings that he's a, no, and actually he doesn't all the time because he's blowing up so badly. Like, you didn't even get one inning on the debut and you didn't get three innings yesterday. So no, he's not an innings eater. They didn't sign this guy to eat innings. Dallas Braden came on our show. Ricky Romero came on our show before the season started. You know what they did? They projected him to win the Cy Young this year, okay?
So yell at them.
No, I'm going to yell at you because you're here, okay? And you just tried to call me that he's an innings eater, that he's a reliable innings guy. I don't give a crap. You can get that for a lot cheaper. You could have gone and got Steven Matz to go eat innings for you for half
no,
the
you
price.
Can't. Have you seen Steven Matz?
Yeah, but anyways, he's terrible. No. Like, but guess what?
His ERA plus for his career is 105. So, like, he's 5% better than average, right? Like, he pitched in a very pitcher-friendly ballpark. But he was good. He was above average as a Minnesota Twin. He was above average for the Blue Jays a season ago. I expect him to be average or above average this season.
So
for the
I.
Blue Jays, he's not, you know, who might win the Cy Young? One of Kevin Gausman or Alek Manoah. And not Jose Berríos.
But I don't like this either. I don't like the idea that just because there's better guys on the team, that Alek Manoah turned out to be a phenom, and that you gave a bunch of money to another pitcher, that somehow, don't worry, you're excused from being an all-star, Jose Berríos. It doesn't matter that they paid you 160 mil. It's that other guys are better than you, buddy, so it's okay. Just go out there and job it around. Like, maybe sometimes you'll be good, sometimes you're bad. Oh, the old Ben Ennis. This is good. This is good to know for your youngest son, is that, hey, as long as the oldest son is good, then you can just be as big a screw-up as you want to be. Like, whatever drugs you want to get into at a way too early age, kid. Like, go ahead. Your older brother is doing well. That's you. That's you as a parent, is what you're saying.
It is. It's just incredible to hear your exact words parroted back to you, like you just did. That's exactly what I was saying about Jose Berríos. No, it's not good, and he's been horrible to start this year. His ERA is 5.62. I just mentioned the career worst across the board. No, he's been not very good, and not what the Blue Jays paid for, but I don't know if you want to do what you did with the offense to Jose Berríos, and then in a couple of months or a month have to apologize to Jose Berríos. I mean, maybe this is the worst year of his career, and maybe, like, immediately upon putting pen to paper, he's turned into a non-factor in the rotation, or
doubt it.
Maybe he's just had a couple of bad starts sprinkled in with some good starts. It should, like, not every start has been horrible. Yeah. I know it's not what you want to hear. No, okay, again, like, this is not me talking to Jose Berríos saying, hey, you've been good. You've been good.
Are you his agent?
Yeah, it is just kind of funny. It's just like, hey, there's some good starts sprinkled in there, too. Like, you've been doing really good.
Well, with the Hyunjin Ryu start, there was no, like, moment of hey, there's the old Hyunjin Ryu. No, it was just bomb after bomb after rocket after rocket after it left his arm. Pardon me?
You think Ryu's like a three-inning opener now? Like, you see a lot of these guys where they go, like, they go three innings, and that's the new opener? Is it's not just one inning and then the bulk guy? It's like there's a lot of openers now that do, like, three innings. There's a guy that's going to go tonight for the Braves, Spencer Strider, right? Mm-hmm. This guy's punch-out machine. Might know about him because he might be my wake and rake pick of the day. But
right.
They've got these dudes who just go out there and give you three innings, and I kind of feel like that's the bar for me now with Ryu. Is he got dinged up again? They're like, well, how'd you get hurt? And he's like, they made me throw baseball. They're like, well, a doctor told you not to do that anymore. I have a really hard time seeing him ever being more than four. Like, if he gives you five innings, you're going, wow, miracle! Like, this is what you want.
Hey, remember how fun Hanjin Ryu was to watch in 2020?
Oh my god!
He's, and then even the beginning
highlight
of last
of the
year.
Pandemic, you know, like all those cardboard cutout. Remember the awfulness of having to talk to Joe Biagini about cat stuff in cardboard cutouts in Buffalo? It was horrible, but at least we had that. We had two things that year. We had Thomas Hatch being the guy that you and I bought all the stock of, thinking that he was going to be incredible, and the Hanjin Ryu.
Yeah. Well, I don't
and
think
that
he's
ballpark
come any-
where it made Rowdy Tellez. He was like, Rowdy Tellez is really good, and then it turned out he was. It confused us.
Anyways, no, Hanjin Ryu doesn't seem like he will ever rediscover those heights. Okay, and even the beginning of last year, remember he was good to start last year. It, I mean, even in that start where he managed to gut through five, he got two swings and misses. It really does feel like. Yeah, you'd be ecstatic if you can get Hanjin Ryu through five innings every 5 days.
Yeah, and then one of these days, apparently, we'll find out that Nate Pearson's going to try to throw again, and that will be.
No, he started his rehab.
Yeah,
in
Dunedin. I've heard,
I think we've heard that 100 times.
No, I mean you can actually look at box scores where he's pitched it.
Nice.
Yes.
Right.
And I just, when he actually joins the Major League Baseball team and does Major League Nate Pearson things, like he's with Julian Merriweather, will always have that Tom Verducci article because he came out and threw 100 for two games and looked great. With Nate Pearson, we'll always have the blowout loss to Tampa Bay where he came in and struck out some guys and we went, whoa. Yeah. It's like those are the two high watermarks so far for two guys that I'm not sure. It's like if you watch a lot of baseball, which I do because, you know, I gamble on sports and it's summertime now. I've noticed that a lot of guys throw pretty hard around baseball, and I'm kind of curious as to why either of these two guys were such a major story for as long as they were. I know Merriweather kind of turned it where it was he didn't throw 100 and then he did, but yeah, mm-hmm. Nate Pearson maybe got a little bit too much hype.
I mean, at the time, like we don't have to go back very far to you know, the before the Hunter Greens. Like Hunter Green is a new development. Guys didn't always throw 102, and certainly when Nate Pearson was a prospect, because he's certainly not a prospect anymore. Yeah, 100 used to mean something different, but I don't know why. You know, how come the velocity inflation hasn't turned into Nate Pearson now throwing 105? How come? Yeah. Why is that? How come he's stuck at 100? Everybody else, Hunter Green's out here throwing 102.
JD hates Hunter Green. Don't bring him up on this show.
I don't hate Hunter Green. I just tease Dan Shulman because he loved him so much. Dan Shulman did like 45 promos for the Hunter Green start. And then when I brought up how he likes him, he's like, what do you mean? I never, like, come on. I watch all the games. I saw you do it, Dan. I know you're excited for this guy. Okay, so I'm excited for this topic. It's time for something to chew on. Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
I think right now, Alejandro Kirk is the toughest out on the team. I don't think that he's the best hitter, but I just think that like he's the toughest out. Like, on a big spot, George Springer usually just, you want him up there because you know he's not going to give you something easy, right? Like, last year I thought it was Semien who was the toughest out on the team, and then it became Vladimir Guerrero Jr., just the best hitter in baseball. Like, that's just the way that it was, and that's the way that it is. Right now, Kirk is in the middle of a stretch where I just feel like you're lucky if he just tops one early in the at-bat. And, like, what you're really hoping for is that he sees a pitch early, that he squares up, but he just nails it right to somebody. You know? Like, that's your best possible outcome. Most of the time, it's like, this dude is just working walks. He's got this incredibly difficult strike zone where umpires are like, ball. You're like, I don't know. Where's the guy supposed to throw it? Like, you look at that thing and you go, this is a really, really, really tough guy. You know what it kind of reminds me of is a little bit of Biggio's dad is the – no, Bagwell. Remember when Jeff Bagwell used to do the, like, hunch down thing move where it was like,
hey, you're going to bring up – Bill Veeck, the former owner of the White Sox, used to bring in, like, you know, he famously had the disco demolition day where they blew up all the records in the middle field and lit everything on fire. But they brought in a little person to play a game, I believe, Yeah. And then, like, yeah, he didn't take the bat off.
It's like the sumo wrestler thing, except for just, like, looking for blocks, except for in goalie where they go put the sumo in net. I didn't know that story. But either way, it's just he's dialed in right now. He looks great to the point where I go, okay, well, maybe this guy can be your DH, honestly. Like, if he's just going to walk this much and hit the ball hard, then maybe it doesn't need to be for power if he's getting on base every single time, right? Especially if the guys behind him are hitting. He hasn't been – I don't know. Earlier in the year, I thought he was more of a liability on the base paths. Hasn't felt that way recently. Danny Jansen, though, he's just been it's like, is this really who he is? Because we have a whole month sample of last year. Everybody's talking about being a pull hitter. We had him on during the summer. He's like, yeah, I made a swing adjustment. And usually that's when you start to get crazy talk like Nunu Randall, right? You go, well, I bought a pitching machine. But this actually seems to be like a real adjustment to his swing. You remember that this guy was supposed to be a bat. He was supposed to be a stick when he came into Major League Baseball, and then they transitioned him into being a glove. And then their best prospect in the minors is supposed to catch at some point. Probably not with this team right now, but what? You're going to take Matt Chapman's glove off of third base so that Aravis Martinez could play? Like, eventually there's going to be some kind of rubber meets the road situation here with these three guys. I don't know if you're going to carry three catchers. I don't know what the move is here. The question I'm asking you is the greatest inevitability that one of these three guys gets moved for left-handed hitting?
Yeah, I mean, it's your – if you want to go huge, like you want to make a trade for somebody with some actual team control.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not talking about go get Corey Dickerson again. I'm talking about a real move here. Like when – because they're clearly going to try to address this one thing they're missing, which is lineup versatility. And it's feeling more and more like we used to always do the what prospect cash are you going to give up. Now it just feels like you got three studs and it just – there's no room for – your organization's best prospect.
Yeah, the way I view this is you have two studs, potentially, and one potential stud, and one highly rated, highly touted prospect who's produced across the minor leagues, all levels, although the power hasn't
been there.
Break
that down for me in terms of how they are those into you and who's who in all these scenarios, because I think people would not know you. Like, you said you have two studs, but one's a potential stud and one's... Do that again, but with their names.
Okay, no, I think the two studs are... Okay. I know it's really basically 2.5 months of Danny Jansen being this, but like you said, this guy has a pedigree of hitting. It was the glove that needed developing and might have resulted in negatively impacting the bat when he turned himself into an average to above average defender behind the plate. Alejandro Kirk has only been this his entire career. He has a career on base of .350. He's played over 110 games.
Yeah, it's legit. It's legit.
Yeah. And he's always been, I think the defensive stuff has been overstated, and he's maybe even taken steps in that regard. Best case scenario for Gabriel Moreno is what? Like, he's as good as these guys? How much better is he going to be? Like, I don't see anybody saying he's going to be a 50 homer guy, right?
That's the perfect take, buddy.
Yeah, he's not. He's not going to be. No, well, and yes, at this moment, he looks great, but how many – he is not a Vlad Jr. and not even a Bo Bichette. But Bo Bichette, remember, was no sure thing when he arrived at the major leagues. Absolutely would be – if you're taking a big swing and trying to, again, land somebody with years of team control, I would 100% have Gabriel Moreno out there as a potential a trade bait. Yeah.
I can't tell you how happy this makes me in terms of you having this right one, because, and the reason I brought this to you is because I have gotten a lot of texts from friends and tweets and things of which one of Kirk or Jansen would you trade? And I keep going, neither. I would trade neither. I would trade the guy who is not on the team, and you're trying to win right now. Danny Jansen has two more years of arb control left. Like, there's no urgency here. Kirk just got to the major leagues. Neither of these guys is, like, under the gun. If Danny Jansen was a free agent next year, I'd be like, oh, okay, well, this is a swing that maybe you end up taking. You move him now or whatever. But no, you have two unbelievable catchers, both who catch the team well. Like, you want... you want this kid coming up here, Gabriel Moreno, and what, learning the position on the fly? Like, we've seen what it looks like in terms of the challenges of doing this out of the gate for these guys and how it can get into your head. Catcher is the number one position that misses the most in Major League Baseball. And yeah, do I think that it's a lock that Gabriel Moreno, like, his bat's obviously good enough that he doesn't need to be a catcher, right? Like, maybe he's a third baseman. But like I said, one of the team's most valuable commodities is Chapman's defense at third base. Like, every time it's hit there, it's an automatic out, which is even more infuriating with Berríos, because his whole thing is supposed to be inducing ground balls over that area of the field. And you go, come on, just put the ball down over to that guy, and he'll figure it out from there. But I'm with you. I just feel as though the kind of sneaky story that's building up here is you should be, like, putting a bat signal out, like, give us your best offer for this guy, this stud who's going to tear his way through AAA and needs to have a spot. And maybe it's going to burn you down the line. Like, 3-4 years from now, Gabriel Moreno ends up better than these guys and whatever. The waves. I just think that you got to operate in a reality of what do you actually have. And what you actually have seems to be the best catcher combo in baseball.
Yeah, I think that you don't have to do anything, right? Like, you don't have to trade him, right? You talk about, hey, asset management and having, you know, his path to the major leagues clogged up by these two guys. Nobody says he has to be in the major leagues this year, right? And nobody says he has to even start next year in the major leagues.
Except at the beginning of the season, the first 3 weeks, we were like, get Gabriel Moreno up here. When is, like, he coming?
He's already, Ailish is right. Like, when the bats struggle,
we
he's the first
pumping.
Team.
I think
he needs to learn how to play the outfield. Like, that's what he's got to do. I'm serious. I'm not even kidding. He has to learn how to play an outfield position. Like, how are you going to play here?
I can't speak to that because I have no idea his build. But I mean, there's been many a catching prospect that has moved off that position. The thing is, if you can hit at that position, I mean, the Blue Jays getting their whatever 830 OPS out of the catching position is such a huge coup, because the Yankees are like, yay, we have catchers that play defense, and, you know, OPS 650, and Jose Trevino, he's like our favorite player now. That's what Major League Baseball teams do. But if you can get like a Buster Posey, you win World Series.
Sure. I agree. It's just that the Jays might have two Buster Posies. That's the only thing. This might have two. That's no big deal, but this might have two guys that do that. This Insider was brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. Ben Ennis of Fan Drive. It's always fun. We got to go because we got to go talk to Stan Van Gundy, and he's better than you.
All right.
Thank you for your time, though. This was still great. This was really great. This was really great.
Thanks. Thanks,
see you,
guys.
Pal.
Bye.
More credit to Boston's defense or Miami's lack of offense? Stan Van Gundy, former NBA head coach and current NBA analyst for TNT, next on the Fan Morning Show. JD and Ailish, Sports at 590 of the Fan.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590 of the Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, JD and Ailish holding it down on Monday. We had a Game 7 last night. There's nothing better in sports than a Game 7. Let's see how Stan Van Gundy, former NBA head coach and current NBA on TNT analyst, feels about it. Good morning, Stan.
Good morning.
Last night, great game. It comes down to the final possessions. What was the story of the game for you?
Well, the story of the game was I thought Boston was the better team throughout, 44 minutes of the game. The only real weakness I think that we have seen from Boston over the course of these playoffs is they don't play well with a lead down the stretch in games. They try to run the clock down early. They started playing the clock with 4.5, 5 minutes to go last night, up 13 points and just struggled to score, couldn't get good shots. Miami's on the attack at the other end. And so the game got a lot closer than it needed to be, close enough that, Jimmy Butler had a wide open three. Not that he's a great three-point shooter, but he had a wide open three with, 16 or 17 seconds to go in that game to put Miami ahead.
Yeah, it's tough to criticize Jimmy Butler there because, he played the entire game. The entire offense seemed to just be, okay, Jimmy, like, please score baskets for us. Otherwise, we don't have much else that's going to be able to happen for us. You really did feel like if he gets the line there or that he scores there, that maybe Boston just ends up crumbling. As a coach, Like, what is it about a team where that just doesn't have where that happens, right? Like, where you're trying to get your team not to tighten up in those moments. Is that just something that it takes a team like Boston that's still got some young stars time to develop? Like, how does that improve? Because that has happened a few times.
Yeah, I don't think they tighten up. I think that team has risen to the moment very well in the playoffs. I don't think that it's that they can't play under pressure. I think they just, when they have that, you know, lead 10, 12, 13 points, four and a half minutes to go, they start playing the clock and thinking they're going to run out time. And the problem is when you're running down that shot clock, it makes it awfully tough to get good shots, and that's a lot of time left for your opponents to come back. Like Boston, really, their most success they had yesterday was getting out in transition, and as the game went on in the fourth quarter, they didn't even attempt to run anymore. I mean, they didn't want to score early in the shot clock, which is where they had success, and so that's something going into the final series. I think that they're going to need to correct because the Warriors, we know, are capable of scoring a lot of points quickly. And if you're up 10 or 12 with 4 minutes to go, you need to keep scoring if you're Boston. You cannot try to put the game on ice at that point.
We're talking to former NBA head coach Stan Van Gundy. I'm curious what impresses you most about Ime Udoka and what he's done in year one with this team. Again, this Boston Celtics group was 500, or very early, or like very deep into this season, and now they're heading to an NBA Finals.
Yeah, I think what was most impressive about what Udoka did over the course of the year is he just had great belief in the vision he had for the team and how he wanted them to play. And he wasn't deterred when things didn't go well early. You know, they did tweak and make some adjustments, but basically they stayed with what his plan was, you know, playing with a lot of size, switching defense, and just kept encouraging his stars to make quicker decisions and to think as much or more about making plays for their teammates as they did about scoring. And it took some time for everything to come together. It took some time for Al Horford to find his rhythm after basically not playing last year. But Ime Udoka stayed the course and was very consistent in what he did. And the Boston Celtics were probably the best team in the league over the last 3 months of the season.
Yeah, defense was just so impressive. Al Horford, incredible down the stretch for this team. Just so, like, it's always great having those kind of guys where Horford's just, he's not even able to hit any shots, but he's doing everything else extremely well for you. And as a coach, it just makes me feel so comforting when you have those just reliable players where you know they're going to be in the right spots, they're going to be doing the right things, they're going to be helping lift you. But their really only trouble seems to have been what you mentioned about trying to run the clock out late in some of these games, but also that they're just not healthy. Like, you see that again yesterday kind of materialize where you're going, okay, well, how much are you getting from certain players? That's the big question for Boston, right? They've got two of their starters heading into this game when they're questionable. Miami obviously doesn't have Tyler Hero, and it's been a big talking point like heading into like throughout these playoffs, which is, why are we seeing so many injuries? Is this an outlier, or is this something that has to actually do with what's going on in the game of basketball today? And I'm curious as to what your position on this is, because a lot of guys are dinged up.
Yeah, listen, there's no question. I think it's been one of the big stories of the playoffs this year. Have been a myriad of injuries to top players, to important guys on teams. And it really is crazy. I mean, we have entered for quite a while, you know, the era of load management and sitting guys out. We're also told that, you know, we have all these advanced training techniques. Teams have invested incredible amounts of money into their performance staff and everything else. And yet more and more guys sit out and for longer and longer periods of time. I don't have an answer for it. I do think one of the problems is, quite honestly, I don't think that guys are in the physical condition they need to be in to meet the demands of the game, and particularly demands of the playoffs, where key players' minutes go up and you're playing at a high intensity level, that we don't have people conditioned enough to meet those demands.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, especially because when I'm watching these playoffs, I thought of you a lot in our conversations about the Raptors, where you had given them a lot of credit for their conditioning. And I kept thinking and coming back to this of, yeah, like, sure, you can end up having things like Scottie Barnes gets a freak ankle injury, right, where he and Joel Embiid collide. But that, yeah, the deeper that they would have gotten the playoffs, I kept thinking, like, they would probably be a little bit better off because they are such a well-conditioned team. And you start to see this with some of these guys where you go, okay, well, how many minutes or how many games did this player play? How many minutes did this player play? And whether or not that's going to be an adjustment. Because it feels more likely to me that teams are going to evaluate it from that standpoint of, like, what are we asking guys and how are we going to better condition them down the stretch, rather than the likelihood of, you know, owners saying we're not going to have play-in games or we're going to, like, pinch the salary. Or the season down a bunch and lose gate revenue.
Yeah, I we've heard a lot of talk about that, particularly with the next TV contract. If rights go up, could they then cut the season down? And it would be interesting to see if that happened and to what the effect would be. And I'm not really sure on that. I think that the quality of play might go up as we cut back-to-backs down even further and got guys more rest. But we're not playing back-to-backs in the playoffs and things like that, and we're still coming up with a number of injuries. So I wish I was the guy sitting there with the answer, but I don't really have it. But it is frustrating. For fans, I think especially, to be watching these games and see so many key guys out in these important games. Like you said, Miami not having Hero last night. And I thought what really came up in that for Miami in that game is, from an offensive standpoint, that's just not a very talented team. They lean so heavily on Jimmy Butler. With Hero, they have a second guy. Who's really their next offensive guy? Kyle Lowry is not what he was when he was with you guys in Toronto from an offensive standpoint. PJ Tucker's not really a scorer. Duncan Robinson had an awful year. Bam Adebayo's limited when he's playing against size. I mean, it's just not that talented a team, and yet they, had the best record in the East.
Yeah, you just saw that over and over and over again in that series. They just didn't have another guy who could create, and they were desperate for it, but they just did not have it. And that's why, like, watching that game, I know Boston's defense is incredible, but even when there's games where they didn't have Robert Williams or they didn't have Smart, I'm going, how much of this is just, Boston's incredible defense versus Miami's just complete ineptitude on this end in terms of guys who can create their own shot or create something for other people? Because, yeah, a lot of good players, but outside of Butler, not exactly a lot of individual scores when Hero's out of that lineup. So our NBA finals are set. It's a very, very exciting matchup. I love this matchup. I always love when it's a team that's on the rise, the team that's on the ascension, facing a team that, is out there for, I don't want to say one last ride, but trying to hold their spot down as champions with Curry, Clay, and Draymond. Biggest point of curiosity for you this series from a matchup standpoint?
Well, the biggest curiosity for me is how the Warriors are going to try to combat the huge size advantage that Boston has. That's, to me, the advantage Boston has had in every series and for the entire year. As the league has moved to playing smaller, Boston plays very, very big, and they can do it because their bigs can all go out on the perimeter and defend, and then their wings are both two-way players who are about 6'8 and 6'10. They have just got incredible size. And the Warriors, on the other hand, not a real big team. And their preferred lineup when they play Green at the five in particular, not very big at all. So I'm anxious to see how that all plays out with the Warriors' lack of size. Now, the Warriors are going to play with a lot more movement in the half court than the Celtics have seen from anybody they've played so far. And I do think that will be tougher for that great Boston defense to have to defend actions off the ball rather than everything be in isolation and pick and roll. I think that'll also be of great interest.
And a few days of rest for both teams will definitely be needed before the finals kick off. Coach, thanks so much for your time today. Enjoy the series, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Stan Van Gundy, former NBA head coach and current NBA on TNT analyst.
Yeah, we'll have a bunch of days to look ahead to Warriors Celtics. I am, again, from a narrative standpoint and an actual style of play, I think this is the best finals that we could have gotten. Like, I think the Suns Bucks would have been really interesting to have a run it back, but if it wasn't going to get those two teams, these are the ones that I wanted. God, there was just a fear in me of watching Miami where they were closing that down and Boston's running the clock out. And I get what Coach Van Gundy's saying, that they did seem a little too focused on running down the clock. But if you looked at some of Boston's later possessions, they're shooting still with like 10 seconds left on the shot clock. There were some earlier shots where Marcus Smart's just wide open. It's just if Marcus Smart knocks down one of those three, four wide open shots that he gets at the end of the game, we're not even really talking about this. It doesn't come down to the Jimmy Butler three or the Max Strus foot on the line call. Like, it just, it's, oh, right, Marcus Smart came out. He was awesome at the beginning of the third, and then he closed it out late in the game, and that's it. That's all. Our next guest, I'm unbelievably excited for. Doesn't do a ton of media, but is doesn't need to because it's Russ Martin, former Blue Jays All-Star. Next on the Fan Morning Show, JD and Ailish, Sports at 590 The Fan.